be critical. Like, think about what you are measuring and why you're measuring it. And does the metric actually represent what you think it does? And so even if you don't use the domains that I've presented in this study, I would love it for you to go out and be very critical and understand the reasoning behind the selection of the test and the selection of the metric.
Hi, Mary. It's my pleasure to have you on Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
My name is Marie-Claire Janot. I typically go by MC in the sport environment. And I just completed my PhD at La Trobe University under the supervision of Dr. Lachlan James, Dr. David Carey, Professor Sam Robertson, and Professor Paul Gaston. I'm now working with the Canadian Sport Institute as a lead S&C coach and data analyst. And I've just started a new position as the IST lead for the Canadian women's volleyball team. And for the Australian listeners, an IST lead is kind of like a high performance manager type position, something along those lines.
Awesome. So high performance sport, data analysis, these are all topics that lead to the topic of today's conversation, which is strength measurement and testing. So let's start with why. Why it is important? Why did you, because that was the topic of your PhD, isn't it?
Yeah, correct.
Why did you go there?
This was the first. Yeah, great. So as you kind of mentioned, this was the part of my PhD in this review that has just been published, kind of kickstarted this whole concept that led to my PhD. And it is well accepted in the strength and conditioning space that maximal lower body strength can be expressed in a number of different ways. This can look like a rapid foot strike in a sprint, a vertical jump to block a volleyball, or a ruck in rugby, where an athlete is moving, you know, not only their own mass, but an opponent and maybe two opponents' mass at the same time. Now, these are all expressions of lower body strength, but as we know, they represent something different, and we use different training strategies to be able to target each of these different strength expressions. And it is important to monitor strength qualities that are expressed in sport. We're not just going to necessarily measure one rep max back squat and assume that it's going to translate to all of the different expressions of strength that I kind of briefly introduced. And so S&C coaches and sports scientists have gone down the route of looking to measure more unique or more specific qualities of strength that are more specific to different force expressions experienced by the athlete. This is really good, but it can be a slippery slope sometimes as we try to refine down to very specific and very like discrete metrics, because it's not necessarily telling us more information than what a bigger, more inclusive metric would. And this is particularly true when we start measuring strength, looking at or using force platforms. They've been used a lot in the literature to measure very unique, very small, different discrete types of strength expression. And instead of creating more clarity on how strength is expressed in sport, it's actually clouded our understanding and created some confusion, because we don't know which metrics are important, which metrics may be redundant. And so that kind of underlined the basis of my PhD, which was, what are these strength qualities that underlie these strength metrics that we regularly collect in the strength and conditioning environment? And how can we best identify them using the wide body of metrics that are available in the literature? And that's kind of under the assumption that there are physical characteristics that underlie performance of a task, metrics related to a specific physical characteristic, such as the ability to produce really, really high forces or the ability to produce force really, really quickly, will likely be highly correlated. So if we have, for instance, peak force in a squat jump and peak force in a counter movement jump, you know, assuming that those are very similar tasks, they likely will be highly correlated, because someone's ability to produce high force dynamically underlies both of those metrics. Now, because of this, it may be advantageous to group metrics that are highly correlated and partition those who are not very highly correlated, as they are likely underpinned by similar or different characteristics. And this kind of led us to this strength classification process, which can be used by practitioners to help guide test and metric selection, as well as the metric interpretation within the strength diagnosis process, with the understanding that there may be a simpler or a more straightforward understanding of what different types of strength characteristics exist, and finding which metric best represents that particular strength characteristic.
All right. So just to please let me know whether I understood correctly. So
sure.
Strength is this big term. We all about strength impact on getting our athletes stronger. But now you can measure it in different ways, and strength can be expressed in different ways too. It can be huge loads moved slowly, or it can be lower loads but moved very explosively. So what we measure, so the tests we use may measure different things to the things that are important for certain athletes, for example. So that would mean that from all the tests that are possible in strength testing, we have to choose the ones that are important for this athlete, for this sport, for this position. And now we have to ensure that the ones we chose will be highly correlated with the underpinning ability or capability that is important for the sport.
Yeah, correct. And just on top of that, you know, we can have a bunch of metrics that are highly correlated to a sport-specific skill. And that may, you know, it may be viewed by a practitioner that that's really good, that all of these metrics are highly correlated to, let's say, sprinting. But if all of those metrics are highly correlated to sprinting, it's likely that they may all tell you the same thing. And we don't necessarily want to just keep comparing an individual strength metric to a sport-specific quality all the time, because that may just be very, very redundant. And, you know, if we're distracting, if we're trying to look at the holistic picture of an athlete and the holistic understanding of strength expression that may be important for sports. So the first step is understanding what exists in an athlete. And this may differ from athlete to athlete, but what range in force expressions or physical characteristics underlie performance of that athlete. And then we can go in and start relating each of those important pieces to sport performance. And then that's when the individual can, or the practitioner can, determine which one of those characteristics are more important than the other.
So would the goal be, this is the ideal profile of the athlete in this sport, in this position. This is this athlete. Something is missing or is lower or is extremely high. Now we want to know what, then we want to related to capabilities, then we want to choose the best test for this capability, then we want to train and then measure again. That's how we would use it?
Yeah, pretty much. So you would figure out, first you would figure out what range of strength qualities exist, and this can be looking at tests of a variety of different constraints, which we'll go into later today. And then you'll be able to reduce them down to, you know, metrics from those tests that tell you something unique. Then you can see where a potential gap is in that athlete. For instance, the athlete jumps high in a cantilever jump, lifts a lot of weight in a squat, has a high peak force in an isometric test, but has really poor reactor strength in a drop jump. We can go in and say, okay, we want to then measure that, or sorry, train that particular quality in the reactive strength because that's lower than everything else. But that may not be as important for a swimmer as it is for a field sport athlete, for instance. And so we can look at these domains or range of strength qualities and first determine which ones are important for sport performance. And then we go in and say, okay, where are the gaps and where do they matter?
All right, so we covered the why. We have a clarity on why we should even care. Now, how did you go about classifying what strength capabilities they are and then the metrics, which one would be paired with which?
Yeah, great question. This was the main basis of this review, was to observe the literature within the context of kind of a threshold-based approach of classification and use that to discuss what potential strength qualities exist. So what we did was we did a literature search and looked for all of the studies that compared two or more different metrics of strength. So there were lots of studies that, for instance, had a cantilever jump and a back squat, and they had a correlation between cantilever jump, jump height, and back squat load. So that's a good example of what exists in the literature. And there are more comprehensive ones as well that looked at more of the relationship. So the, you know, using regression models to see how changes in cantilever jump height relate to changes in one rep max back squat. All of those studies we looked at and tried to summarize, and we've summarized in tables in this review. And what we did was interpreted them in the context of more similar or more different. So we used a cutoff threshold of 50% shared variance and used that to interpret whether or not metrics were very similar or whether or not metrics were more different than similar. And so a 50% shared variance cutoff is an R squared of 0.5 or an R of 0.71. So we used those thresholds throughout and looked at all of the relationships that exist in the literature between metrics. Now, in order to effectively compare metrics, because there are too many to just go one for one throughout the whole body of literature, so we kind of made it a two-step approach. And what we first did was grouped metrics based off of the task that they were derived from. So we used different task constraints to classify or categorize the different groups of tests. We grouped them based off of the external constraint, and that would look like, an external load. And what that would be is either acceleration due to gravity on the center of mass. So that would be a test such as a drop jump or a rebound jump, where you're adding that pre-loading of acceleration on the center of mass prior to the test is performed. Could be an external load such as a barbell. And then there were time constraints. So a task that required a task to be performed within a certain period of time. Now, a good example of this would be the drop jump, where the instructions are given to move as fast and as high as possible. So that's a temporal or timing constraint. And the test needs to be performed ground contact times of less than 250 milliseconds. And so that's a constraint that would then group a test, and how that would differ from something like a counter move and jump, where there are no timing constraints. And then we also grouped them based off of the muscle action. So that's dynamic or isometric primarily. And under the dynamic category, we had non-ballistic and ballistic tasks. A ballistic task would be a jump, whereas a non-ballistic would be something like a one rep max deadlift or squat. And so in the first round of comparisons, we used that threshold approach to compare metrics that existed in the same test category. So for instance, within the counter movement jump, we looked at jump time and the correlation between jump time and jump height and all of those different metrics that exist, all from what's available from the literature. And from that, we determined whether or not different potential classifications or groups of metrics tended to emerge from within a test category. And then we looked across test categories. So we would look at, for instance, within the reactive strength test type, we would compare metrics from there to an isometric task and see what exists in the literature with different relationships or correlations between those different task types. And by doing so, we were able to fully look at what's available in the literature and in a somewhat systematic approach to be able to understand what types of strength qualities based on these metrics exist.
So did you just go whatever is in the literature with the threshold in mind, whatever was tested or investigated, that's what you used to make a classification?
Yes, exactly. So there were some tests that had a lot of literature on it, such as the counter movement jump and one arm back squat, for instance. There's a decent amount of literature out there for that, whereas other ones, there were not. And so we discussed the potential gaps that existed in the literature, which were pretty evident. There were some pretty gray areas, particularly with the loaded jump and relating that variable to any other strength test.
Where do you want to see the differences and where you are all right with having a more global measure, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. And as part of this research too, there's kind of levels of strength information, you can say. So if we're just looking at dynamic outcomes, so we're just looking at how high, you know, how much impulse can you create dynamically in an unloaded condition, then you'd likely only need one test. But if you want to dig a little bit deeper and understand how that impulse is generated or your strategy behind that, then you can kind of look at another level. And at one point in those layers, depending on your athlete that you're interested in, then you can dig a little bit deeper and include that squat jump in addition to a counter movement jump.
Well, this is really important because what it means for a practitioner who is working with the team is they don't have to go deep enough with all the athletes. They may just need the deeper measurements for some athletes, not the others, which is time saving and so on. So this is really good.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a tendency to go deep pretty quick without kind of zooming out and looking at the big picture. And so there are a lot of options out there to, you know, to go big picture without missing out too much. And so that's definitely the purpose of this work is, okay, can we get 90% of the information by doing 1% of the tests or 1% of the metrics? And the answer is probably yeah. And sometimes you will want to dig into that extra 10%, but that's not always the case. And it's frequently not usually the case.
So you touched on a very important point. So as the technology makes its way to sports science and athlete monitoring, we are tempted to measure everything because we can, but then we end up with huge data sets that are are very hard to process and make sense of, and then use to meaningfully impact the decision making, I guess, on either selection or training management and so on. So having structure of metrics, what is measuring what and to what extent and how important global or how in-depth the measurement is actually super useful for that reason also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you nailed it.
What did you use and how?
Yeah, so for this review, we use a threshold approach to determine similarity or uniqueness between metric. And for the review, what we did was just look at all of the literature that exists with comparing different metrics under different tests and use the reported either association or correlation. So that's using a correlation analysis and just a single R. We also looked at studies that had relationships between metrics. So that would be after a regression model, you would get an R squared. And then we also looked at, and mostly included in the discussion of the findings, factor analyses or principal component analyses. Now, these existed mostly in comparisons of the counter-movement jump, but they also existed in other spaces as well, where they were looking at the component loading of different metrics from different tests to determine, you know, how many different types of strength expression existed, essentially what we're doing here. And so although those are hard to directly compare to correlation analyses or regression analyses, they provided extra strength essentially to our findings with those correlation and regression analyses. And so we use those values to cluster anything that was an R squared of 0.5 or greater into the more similar than different category, and everything that was 0.49 or less R squared in the more different than similar category. And that equated to a cutoff of an R of 0.71. So we used those parameters to help discuss the findings. There were some that kind of crossed that gray area, and those were discussed in the context of, you know, kind of the crossing zero of this. Some of them are more similar, some of them are different, but a lot of them that we're pretty certain about kind of really fell into the one camp. So we're either a lot similar or a lot different throughout the literature.
Awesome. Could we go step back and could you simply explain what did you use correlation for and what did you use regression for?
So all we did was look at the results from the recent studies, and some had used correlation analyses and some had used regression analyses to compare the relationships between different metrics of strength. And so for the purpose of this study, we kind of took them as very similar result. So if there was a correlation of, let's say, 0.88, we would know that that would be in the more similar than different category. So metrics such as jump height and takeoff velocity of a counter movement jump, because they're derived pretty much from the same variable, they were like a 0.99 correlation. And so there were some of the metrics that really existed far in that end. And then with the regression analyses, the same process was gone through, but they would be interpreted as an R squared. So a 0.5 would be more similar than different, whereas a 0.49 would be more different than similar. So it's all we did with that was just interpret the findings in that context or in that systematic approach.
So whatever the authors of the original study used, you would take that and interpret it according to your cutoff points.
Yes, exactly. Which was a bit difficult sometimes because if we're just looking at a single measure, we all know as S&C coaches that the way a test is performed can greatly affect the metric. And so we're just looking at that single outcome metric, the correlation between two measures, you know, there's a lot of assumption behind that, but that was part of the review process. And I think we did an okay job to explain the limitation of this approach, but it just helped guide discussion. And like I said, there were some that were very end ranges and we could be pretty certain about those things. The stuff we just said, hey, we don't know, and we need to improve our research to be able to find out how to sift through that.
Fair enough. A tricky question, maybe too detailed question, but I had a person here on the evidence central talking about how the cues for a drop jump will influence the outcome. So whether the athlete is instructed to jump as high as possible or to rebound as fast as possible will influence what metrics will be elevated versus depressed. So was it enough studies to go into that level? So did you separate what the cue was used and then what the correlations were between the metrics.
I'm really happy you asked that, because that actually was one of the main discussion points at the end of our paper. And we didn't necessarily, because the cues were kind of not always reported, we didn't necessarily go to the cues, but we did compare the contact times. So when it was reported, we could see that the metrics from the drop jump that were derived from a test that had less than 250 milliseconds of contact time were unique from a countermovement jump. So if we're talking about jump height and jump height, they were unique if the constraints of the drop jump were, like you said, jump high and jump fast, and they had a contact time of less than 250 milliseconds. But if in some cases where the contact times were elongated past the 250 milliseconds, then the relationship between countermovement jump and drop jump metrics were much closer. And so they would actually be grouped into the same category. So this was a really important finding that, you know, the task constraints greatly influence the discovery of these strength domains or strength qualities. And so we have to be very specific when we are conducting these tests so that we understand how the test is performed, what the outcome of the test is trying to be, what we're trying to gather from that test. And if for some reason a person can't do a drop jump with a contact time of 250 milliseconds, then it likely isn't the right test for them. They're not measuring a reactive strength quality. So we have to consider all of those factors when we are implementing this testing.
Ah, I like finding things. I thought that it may be a little bit too detailed question, but actually looked into it. So
yeah.
Are we ready for the results?
Yeah, sounds good.
Awesome. So what the results?
Okay, so at the end of this whole systematic approach, we found that there were 5 different domains of strength. So we termed them domains of strength, and those were reactive, unloaded dynamic, loaded dynamic, maximal isometric, and early isometric. Yes. So these group of strength metrics were discovered by first comparing within the task category, and then again across task categories, as we mentioned. But there were some considerations. So like I mentioned previously, the reactive strength category is highly dependent on how the test is performed. So as we mentioned, if you get a contact time greater than 250 milliseconds, then it actually, the metrics derived from that test actually group in the unloaded dynamic category. And so in order for it to be a distinct domain of strength, the task has to be performed a certain way. And so that was a main kind of outcome of our study. Another notable finding was within the unloaded dynamic strength category, as there's a decent amount of literature to suggest that there are actually different strength qualities that can be discovered within the unloaded dynamic strength category. So for instance, the timing of the test. So we're talking about a counter movement jump here. The timing of the counter movement, the force input of the counter movement. So we're talking about like mean concentric or mean propulsive force, the outcome. So we're talking about jump height there. And then there are also some other movement strategy characteristics, such as the speed of the depth of the counter movement. So those all kind of emerged in this study and some other studies as likely unique characteristics. But when those metrics were compared across task categories, it got a little gray. So we couldn't necessarily find distinctions when measuring outside of the task category. So because of that, we decided to collapse the unloaded dynamic strength to a single quality, but there's a lot of more work that can be done in that area. And then another important finding, the loaded ballistic task. So we're talking about a loaded countermovement jump or squat jump. There is very few studies out there that actually looked at a correlation between a non-ballistic task, such as a 1 rep max back squat or an unloaded countermovement or any other comparisons, really. There were very few studies that looked at the comparison between a loaded ballistic task and an isometric or reactive strength task. So those studies don't necessarily exist when we're looking at it that way. And so because of that, we weren't really able to determine its distinction. So where a loaded jump may be more similar or different than an unloaded jump or a 1 rep max back squat. So that we know there's a spectrum here. We don't know where the difference starts to occur. And so there's more research to be done on where that loaded ballistic task becomes more different than an unloaded ballistic task and vice versa, working the other way around. So that was a big gap identified in this study. And then lastly, another important finding was the distinction between early and maximal isometric strength. So this is something that has been theoretically discovered in individual studies suggesting that early isometric strength produced, so force produced kind of within the first 100 milliseconds or so, may be distinct from your maximal force capability. And we found in the study that it does in fact consistently demonstrate a distinction. So yes, there's a distinction identified between early and maximal isometric strength, where the early isometric strength metric was likely around 100 milliseconds. So force produced at 100 milliseconds is usually the cutoff. So anything past that, so past 150 milliseconds. So if you're measuring force in an isometric task around 200 or 250 milliseconds, it is more similar to maximal isometric strength than it is to the early. So when we are looking at isometric tasks and want to look at a distinction, it's recommended that about 100 or 150 milliseconds is where you measure that strength expression. And anything later, it's very, very similar to maximal. But this is only possible if the task is done with a rapid intent. And what I mean by rapid intent is that it's been instructed to push or pull as fast and as hard as possible. So those two characteristics are critical if we do want to measure rapid strength or this early isometric strength. And that's really important. So it's another example of ensuring that the task constraints are upheld, or else the whole representation of a strength domain won't exist. And so, with some of the force plate technology, you can make a flag or a tag that says if it's done rapidly or not. And I'd recommend doing that because it does influence the interpretation of that metric.
Okay, so now let's go back to the practitioners. How would they go about choosing, I guess?
Yeah, so the first step is determining what your athlete is used to performing. So before we even go down the road of what exists, it's what can the athlete perform? If the athlete has never done an isometric test before, frame them up, show them how to do it, make sure they're used to do it, or else you won't get a maximal expression of force. So that would be my number one advice, is make sure that the tests that you are doing allows for the athlete to express force maximally. Second, figure out what, out of the range of tests, which ones matter the most for your athlete group. So if you're looking at novice athletes who, everyone just needs to get stronger and get exposure to strength conditioning, I wouldn't worry too much about getting the wide spectrum of strength, but I would measure counter movement jump, and I would get jump height. I would get kind of the big rocks measured early. And then when you are working with an athlete group that is well-trained and you are looking at kind of a wide range of strength expressions, the tests that I would recommend are a drop jump or a rebound jump. So one of those two to get a reactive strength quality, a counter movement jump. And from there, you can get the big, strength domain of just unloaded dynamic, but then you can also get all of those other kind of second layer metrics as well. I would then do either a one rep max or a loaded jump squat. Now, these are sometimes avoided by strength trainers or S&C coaches, or, the coaches just say no, or the athletes are like, nah, no way. And so if that's the case, and what I currently do is find ways to do heavy non-ballistic movements and measure the velocity of the bar. So I gain information on that quality by doing assessments of their strength training practices rather than doing a distinct test. And I find that works really well. But measuring that heavy expression of dynamic strength is a unique quality. And so we need to measure it somehow if you do want to fill out that spectrum.
On that,
yeah, go ahead.
Do you cue athletes to, they do heavy squats in the set of 5 reps. Do you cue them to do them as quickly as they can?
That's a really good question. I program to have kind of heavy 3Ds. And so they would be moving them fast. It would be in a maximal intent day. So it's like, hey, these are important. We're trying to get a max velocity on these. And they wouldn't necessarily, they wouldn't jump, but they would move the bar with high intent, I tend to call it. And they, the athletes, when they do have the accelerometer or the linear position transducer on the bar, they tend to push for that higher velocity. And so it works well in my context. I know that's not always the case, but just that's a really good point. If you are using that option, that it needs to be a maximal intent, or else you're not going to measure the quality that you want. And so if you can't get that in training and you need to do a specific testing, then know that that is your option, that you should do the specific testing. And then in addition to the dynamic test, doing isometric test too does seem to measure a unique quality of kind of that, that underlying ability to produce force irrespective of a movement strategy. And so getting a maximal isometric strength and then also a rapid or a strength test, or sorry, strength metric at 100 milliseconds is also what I recommend. Now, if you're trying to avoid the rapid movement in, or it's not a movement, but the rapid intent in an an isometric task, as some practitioners are,
I would say do a slow gradual and just know that you're likely missing that extra bit of information that maybe you want to incorporate later on because it does tell you something unique. But overall, those are the tests I recommend, and you can get most information from those four tests.
Awesome. I have a tricky question now. So
yeah, okay.
Are you familiar with Olympic weightlifting?
Yeah.
That's a sport. So if you would assist a skill coach, a weightlifting coach, and you would propose test battery of tests for a weightlifter, what would be your approach?
Good question. I would first, if I were to do this the really complicated way, I would first measure a series of tests using a force platform and then do some data reduction myself to understand which ones are different, which ones are similar. Now, with weightlifting, with Olympic weightlifting, because these movements, particularly like a mid-thigh pull, is so specific to their sport, it was essentially designed for the sport, you might actually see a very unique emerging elements of strength domains than if you were to measure a field sport athlete, for instance. So what I would do is I would do an unloaded counter move and jump. I likely wouldn't do a reactive strength test due to the nature of their sport. So because they don't necessarily have any cutting or a preload, I wouldn't kind of tap into that realm, as it's not specifically evident to be important for their task. And I think there might be subtle differences in the concentric only aspect of weightlifting that might emerge rather than a reactive strength test. Yeah, I would do a counter move and jump and an isometric mid-thigh pull. And then since like that sport is so dependent on just, obviously it's about how much you lift, you kind of always have a really, really close and really clean understanding of what they can move dynamically. And so the two ends of the spectrum might be where you'd want to measure, because you're not necessarily training those two ends of the spectrum. And so gaining some insight on how what they absolutely can produce and what they can do under the lightest load might give you some insight of what they need to improve in order to get that loaded dynamic task better.
All right. Awesome. Would you have, if you would have to give advice for the coaches, SNC coaches, mm-hmm. or other coaches that may use the study, how they should go about it? What are your take home messages?
Yeah. The biggest one is be critical. Like, think about what you are measuring and why you're measuring it. And does the metric actually represent what you think it does? And so even if you don't use the domains that I've presented in this study, I would love it for you to go out and be very critical and understand the reasoning behind the selection of the test and the selection of the metric. The more that we can understand the even just the math behind it, the more that we can be intentional with selecting different tests. Now, if you are wanting to use the results of this study, and this is particularly helpful for like a field sport athlete type of cohort, I'd recommend starting with those big rocks that I recommend in those five domains, and then moving on to the second layer, which may be presented in my subsequent studies and other authors' subsequent studies that look into the details of each test. But start with the big rocks, do them well, do them consistently, have a grasp of the understanding of what you're measuring, and then go from there. Do a few things and do them well, do them consistently, know what they are. Those will go a longer way.
It's easier to do too, because you can focus on just these things and have the data. Athletes can do them really well. The data is clearer, the variance is smaller, and you know, the data is better quality. Therefore, your reasoning will be closer to what is, hopefully closer to what is going on. So
yeah, exactly. You just limit as many of those potential human errors as possible. And then you get to the real thing.
All right. Okay. So two questions to finish. The first one would be, what is your favorite exercise?
Yeah. So I grew up playing like varsity ice hockey. And so we loved our Bulgarian split squats. And so as much as that's everyone's least favorite exercise, that's still my favorite. I can still Bulgarian, you know, 70 kilos.
All right. Then the last question is, where people can find you online if they want to follow your work and be up to date, or maybe even ask a question? Where should they go?
Yeah, great. My research is always updated on ResearchGate, and you can find me, I think it's MC Janot. And then also on Twitter and Instagram, MC Janot. Those are mostly the platforms that I'll be on. And everything, because I'm the only MC Janot around, is just at MC Janot, and you'll find me in all those places.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mary. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.